Accession number 27058, Reel 9.
This is the sixth reel of a taped interview with Rob Ulrich in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 5th of the 1st, 2004, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Rob, can we talk about, obviously you'd spoken about Paddy and you'd spoken about the aim to get to see Paddy in England and be transferred to England, and that wasn't possible. You've spoken a little bit about Rini as well in
Alexandria.
I wanted to talk about how people are drawn together or placed in a situation where they form a relationship during wartime.
Well, I suppose it's something that just seems to happen. I mean, when I met young Rini, just by simply walking into a bookshop, a simple passage of a few paces, which I can tell you changed my life at that time forever, I was just absolutely staggered at what a beautiful young lady she was. And I've never seen anybody in my life who could match her any for beauty. Stunning. And I pushed off having bought the first book, and I thought about it later, so I went back and had another chat, and I asked her if she'd come and have a cup of coffee with me.
We've spoken about that experience, obviously. In what, to what degree are people sort of forced together, do you think, in a wartime situation?
Well, I don't think forced is quite right. I mean, having seen her any once, I thought if there's any more of that going about, I want to have some of it. So that's why I asked her to come out with me. And when she said, oh, I wouldn't be allowed to go out with you, at this stage she was 4 weeks short of her 17th birthday. Mm. Well, and I asked her why, and she said, why, he says, you should hear the stories that my grandmother tells about the Australians in the First World War. We were told by everybody that when the Australians came, be very careful.
But do you think that there is a certain degree of being in a tough spot, that, that having seen or met someone in a foreign land, there's not likely to be much future in it? Did that's...
No, I didn't even think of that. I mean, I hadn't even really met her once, other than to buy a book from her. And we had coffee that afternoon, and I just said, I'd like to see more of you. Would you care to come to the cinema? Cinema, he says. You should hear my grandmother. So that's why I said, well, I can fix that.
To what degree did you, as the relationship developed, to what degree did you sort of look to the future, given the circumstances?
Well, I never looked into that future with being very serious, because I've always believed that if you marry into a culture other than your own, there are risks. There are severe risks. Irini, I know, and because I was told by somebody, had had servants since the day she was a baby. I know that Irini had never washed a pair of stockings in her life. She'd never washed an undergarment in her life. She didn't do her own hair. She didn't do her own nails. She didn't even bath herself. When she came home each day after the office closed for the afternoon, a servant would run a bath for her. The servant would bath her. And when she got out, she'd be dried by a servant and dressed by a servant.
Did you ever think, this is a ridiculous situation to get into, given the fact that if I fly off tomorrow, I may not come back?
Oh, that was very true. That's why I'd never get married in wartime, because if Irini and I had got married during one of our leaves, and I'd left Irini slightly triggered at the time, gone back to the squadron and been shot up the bum the next week, which is quite possible, Irini would have been a widow before she was 20, and the biggest problem of all, she would have had a baby in time that was not a true Greek. The bloodline would have been, what's the word? Kind word. The bloodline would have been, I can't think of it, fine Australia. But the child would not have been true Greek. And that could have been an enormous problem to her any. Now, I never considered matrimony at any stage.
What about ringing?
We never talked about it. For a while there, we did become very, very close. Did I tell you she gave me a crucifix once? Well, we talked about that a bit, and she made me promise, you know, hand on heart stuff, that I would wear it every time I took off, which I did, and it worked because here I am. But when the war came to an end, or when I was going to Yugoslavia, I knew that it was unlikely I'd ever come back through Alex again, so I gave it back to her. It had obviously been in a family for years and years and years.
What was that like, to know that you possibly may never see this person again?
Well, that was a fact of life in those days. One of the things you did mostly in the Air Force was to move. Up if you were lucky, back if things were not going your way. But whatever it was, you moved here, there and all over the bloody place. And I had no idea that I'd ever see her any again. After the war, I showed my mother a few glamour photographs that Irini had taken for me, and they were stunning photographs, taken by a professional photographer, and you wouldn't believe how beautiful she looked. And my mum had a look at that and said, oh, seems like a very nice young lady. My stepfather, who was a very quiet man, he was a member of the state government in those days, and he astounded me one evening by saying, if you'd like to bring your little Greek girlfriend out here for a holiday, she can stay with us as long as she likes. And as I'm a member of the government, state government, if there are any holdups for immigration or anything silly like that, I can smooth them over. And I said, well, that's good. So I wrote to Irini and said, come on out. And she wrote back and said, I'd love to come and meet your mother and I'd love to see where you live, but Mum won't let me come. And in those days, Greek mothers were the sole authority. Mm. I do believe then, and I believe it now, that Mrs. Noitakis wouldn't let her come, because for the first time in 19 and a half years, Irini would be away from her mother's influence and control. Irini may have liked the free and easy life we had out here, to be independent. She thought that was good. And had there been any matrimonial conversation, which Mrs. Noitakis didn't know about, Irini may have agreed. That means she'd have lost her daughter.
To what degree mm-hmm. was it just a situation of companionship?
I think it was a bit more than companionship. For a while we became very, very, very close. And I thought a great deal of Irini, and I think I can say with due confidence that she was looking at me in a fairly serious light. In fact, her next door neighbour in their apartment block was a Mr. Watkins, who had a daughter, Ivy, who was going out with a bloke in 3 Squad, where I was, which I knew. And Mr. Watkins said to me one day that he invited me to their Christmas lunch, and of course Irini was there, and he took me to one side and poured me a couple of nice cold beers and said, I have to tell you, and this view is supported by Ivy, that Irini, once you're here, is beginning to look at you in a very serious light. I said, oh, yeah? And he said, yes. So I thought, well, fair enough, and I wandered off. And I thought then, well, we don't have servants. Irini had been raised by servants, and it could have been a problem. But the overriding fact for me to think about was that I always believed very passionately that if you do marry into a culture and a religion that is not yours, there could be problems. Irini was her religion was Greek Orthodox, which is very similar to our own Church of England as it was in those days. But the problem would have been for me, Irini was Greek and I wasn't.
The sort of sense of commitment or lack of in that sort of relationship.
Oh, I was very, very, very fond of young Irini. But the overriding factor for me was she was used to servants. My family probably couldn't spell servants, let alone explain what a servant was, which would have been a problem. And the other thing, she was still Greek and I wasn't. when I was thinking about the bloodline, polluted was the word I was trying to think of. And of course, the Greeks relied terribly on the bloodline.
On your leaving
Alex.
Alex, mm-hmm. and on your leaving Africa and heading off to Yugoslavia eventually,
mm-hmm.
was there talk of you parting and the possibility that you might meet other people?
No. When I got the signal that I had to go to Italy, I told Irene I was going to Italy, and she said, "Oh, well, are you going to write to me?" And I said, "Oh, yeah," which I did. And we wrote for years and years and years and years after the war. In those days, we used to get what were called aerogram forms. Did you ever see them? It was one single sheet of paper which you folded in four pieces, adhesive flat, one page or one and a half page. And a very convenient way of writing, very easy to use. And it really used to use the whole page and the other part on the other side, half page. And one day I got a letter. Oh, we'd been writing for 7 or 8 years, and I got an aerogram of about 5 lines, and I thought, something's up. And she said, "Dear Bob, this is the last letter I'll be able to write. I'm being married at 10 o'clock Saturday morning. Thank you for a whole lot of memories. Love, Irene." That was it. So I wrote back something appropriate saying I wished her all well, all the happiness in the world, and I did, and that was it. But where she did now, just after the war finished, when the first president of Egypt announced himself as Gamal Nasser, I think, an ex-army officer, when they booted out the useless King Farouk. And the first thing Nasser did, one of the first things Nasser did, he forced all the Greeks to leave Egypt. No one knows why, because the Greeks played a very large role in the business of the country. But he forced them all out. So where Irene went, I don't know. I don't even know if she married, whether he was an Egyptian. Wouldn't think she married an Egyptian, wouldn't think. Don't know. Mm. But that was it.
In relation to Yugoslavia, you also talk of Patty.
Yep.
Tell us about the situation with Patty, and given, obviously, that you had become close with Ring.
Yeah. Well, I'd been to Corsica for a little while, and I'd lived with a French family in Bastia, which is that's the capital of Corsica, very small place, very pretty, and everyone was very, very friendly. And it was obvious that we were winning the war, because there's Bastia in Corsica, and I was based in Termoli, which is about there. I could have gone in a straight line for about 45, maybe 55 minutes. Aha, no. We were winning the war, so all sorts of new regulations were coming into force immediately, or possibly sooner. And you had to fly what were known as safe routes. Oh boy. The RAF, where they start to make up regulations, really go overboard. So a safe route was to take off from Bastia, fly down the east coast of Corsica, a 45-degree starboard turn over the Straits of Bonifacio, fly down the west coast of Sardinia, land at a place called Cagliari and refuel, did all that. Then from Cagliari you flew across the Mediterranean to Marsala, which is a very, very nice township on the west coast of Sicily. And in Marsala, they are noted for a very, very, very beautiful red wine they make, which is also used to make lots and lots of eggs in this Marsala wine. It's beautiful. From Marsala, straight across to Catania on the east coast. From Catania, to fly up to, I forget where it was, somewhere in Italy, and then straight up to Termoli. But as I was flying along en route for Termoli, I passed a very large port city called Bari on my right hand. And this was about 3:30 in the afternoon. And of course Bari was the headquarters of everything that moved in the Mediterranean. The headquarters of the Royal Navy, the headquarters of the RAF, when I was a part, the headquarters of the British Army, the headquarters of partisans, and everything was there. This is about 3:30, and I thought, now, Termoli was 200 miles up there, about an hour five flying, and I thought, I know so many people in Bari, if I fly back to the squadron, I'm going to see the same people making the same comments and the same bloody whinges and wailing that you get every day. What I might do, all on my own initiative, is do a crafty right-hand turn and fly to Bari and spend the night there, because I'm sure I can get into a reasonable amount of trouble without even trying too hard. Bari, here I come. Turn around, flew to Bari, just landed, and said, yep, all's well, fill her up, please. So I hopped, grabbed a truck which was going into Bari, got to Bari, and the Italian name for restaurant can be Taverna Tavola, which is, they mean small restaurants or small something. And there were dozens and dozens and dozens of them. And I knew hundreds of people in Bari, because I didn't go anywhere near RAF HQ, because I wasn't supposed to be there. And I went into every tavola I can think of, every taverna, didn't know a soul. I thought, oh, yeah, they must have moved the place where I was looking. So I said, I'll go to the Kiwi Club, no people there, billiard room, thousands of French from. Went to the Kiwi Club, booked in for the night, and that cost me 25 lire in those days, which was about 2 and 6 pence. Walked all through the Kiwi Club, never saw a soul. Never saw a soul I knew. And I thought, God, what do you do now? And there was about an hour before I could get a meal. And of course, it was too late to get back to the old Hurricane, because we had no night flying facilities at Termoli. So I thought, oh, well, I'll go to the library and get a book and read something for an hour, then it'll be dinner time. Right. So I walked into the library and came upon Miss Ching, who was the librarian.
Got something with women and books?
I just going to say the same thing. And I looked around and talked to Miss Ching for a while and told her what I was interested in the way of books, and she put me onto something. All I wanted was an hour's reading. So I went back just before meal time, counted back and said, thank you very much.
That sounds like a bit of a chat-up line to me.
Yep, probably. And that was it. And the next morning, had breakfast, shushed off back to Termoli. But the next time I went down to Bari, I made a point of looking up Miss Ching. And we became very friendly very quickly. And as we got to know each other far better over quite a long time, we often used to talk about how extremely well we got on right from the first 5 or 10 seconds. You know, we were chatting away as though we'd been friends for years.
Well, I'm interested in that because you mentioned you become friends very quickly in a very short space of time, something that might not have happened had there not been a war on.
Yeah, quite likely, I suppose, quite likely. But just after that, a great piece of fortune fell my way. I was doing something one day and the CO, a fellow called Ronald Slade Betts, an Englishman, very, very fine bloke, said to me, Lord, the CO, the group captain wants to see you. Of course, the first thing I thought of was, God, what have they found out about? And he said, well, not to worry about. In fact, it's a little bit to your advantage. So I said, oh, yes. So we went to see the group captain, who was a very nice bloke. He was one of the original pilots of the Battle of Britain, but he'd been shot down and very, very badly injured, very badly injured. I'd say that his life would have been brought to an end many years before his time because of his injuries. But he was an extremely nice bloke to talk to. He'd been badly burned, and where he had his goggles on, the skin there was as normal. But from there down was just one great big red wheel. It looked as though he'd been half beheaded. And his hands were like that. How he wrote anything, I don't know. But they were all just massive red tendons and sinews, and they looked awful. He used to wear gloves nearly all the time. But how he held a pen, I don't know. But I'll tell you what, he could hold a treble scotch in a way that would bring admiration from being around the world. But he was a very nice bloke. Anyway, we went and sat down, and he said, Robert, I've got a proposition for you. I said, yes, sir. And he said, I believe you've got a little girly chum in Bari. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, a situation has arisen which may be of some benefit to you. And I said, yeah, what's this fellow on about? And he said, the situation now is that we are here in Termoli, and Group HQ is in Bari, which 200 miles to the south. And I said, yeah, know that. And he said, well, the communications between us and Group HQ is not always satisfactory. So we've decided we will appoint a person who should be known roughly as HQ Group Liaison Officer. And he said, inasmuch as you've got a very attractive little girly chum in Bari, perhaps you might be interested in the appointment. I said, yes, sir, would very. He said, but I have to tell you this, we don't want to create a belief that you're getting favourable treatment because you're in Australia or something. We have enough flack already from group people here because this is an RAF unit and we've got an RAAF bloke as a senior flight commander. And we carry a little bit of flack out of that. But you'll have to keep your flying hours up. Don't do anything that's going to make us embarrassed. Right. So we walked off and then they made me the wing liaison officer. And I had a reason, well, I manufactured a reason to get down to Bari at least once a week, for no other reason, to see Paddy. And this was rather a charade, I suppose, which was not without a tumour. Everybody knew that Ulrich was going to Bari to see his little girlfriend, Paddy. But everyone pretended that Ulrich was going to get on most important military matters, and I'd doubtless be meeting the Prime Minister in about 4 or 5 minutes, and maybe even King George later on. I was on very, very important business, and everybody pretended that was all utter rubbish. I used to see Paddy, and of course, I saw Paddy very frequently. And
do you think that you would have acted so swiftly, had the courage possibly, if you knew that you had to sort of make friends quickly? You had to, you know.
Oh, no, I don't think it's a matter of courage. It was just something I thought that should be done. And as Shakespeare said, if 'tis to be done, 'tis to be done swiftly. I used to read a fair bit of Shakespeare. I haven't done that for years. But anyway, she was an extremely attractive young lady. Very attractive young lady, in fact. And as I say, we got on so well that everything just seemed to fall into place quite nicely.
Well, she wasn't Greek. No. Was there talk of...
No. I would never, ever get married during wartime. But there was one other thing that sure caused me so much embarrassment. Very embarrassment. Probably the greatest level of embarrassment in my life. My only education, if you could call it that, you couldn't really call it that, really. I don't know what you call it. It was a state school, and I didn't know it at the time, not a very good state school. That was the only level of education I had. And Patty was a very, very, very well-educated young lady. She was very bright, well-educated, and was really out of my class when it came to ordinary educational matters. And that was something I had to live with for some time. But when she went to England, I went to the group captain.
You mentioned that you wanted to go to England too.
Yep.
So was it a situation of we'll meet again, don't know where, don't know when?
Very much so. And I knew she was going to London, or somewhere. She was going to what was called the Kiwi Club, which was then in London.
Did you consider that after the war you might meet up with her?
Well, New Zealand's not all that far away, but I still had this problem of the educational difference. I mean, you know, Patty was just so far ahead of me in just general matters of general education.
Things that possibly might matter in civilian life.
Could be.
To what degree did they not matter in military, in wartime?
Well, if Patty and I went out on Thursday night, that's fine. I might have been shut up the bum on Saturday morning.
Didn't matter how dumb you were.
No. See, one thing you have to keep in mind, that if you are indulging in operational flying during wartime, you've got a fair chance of being killed. And that happened to quite a lot of people that I know of, and I don't see why I would have been any different. But we never got to that stage of talking about that. I think Patty realised it without actually telling me about it, but as I say, she was a person who used to look ahead a little bit,
I wanted to discuss the idea of live for the moment. How did that affect relationships? How did that affect people getting to know or not getting to know one another?
Well, as far as I know, it didn't affect anybody. Everybody who was a pilot like I was in the same boat. It didn't matter who you met or how you met somebody. In 48 hours, you could be dead.
Well, that's what I mean. You've got to live for the moment now, mate. You might, you know, tomorrow we die sort of thing.
Well, anything that involved Patty, I gave very careful consideration to. And I know that we enjoyed each other's company very, very clearly. And whenever I could get down there, Patty was always available to see me. Never once did she say, I can't see you, I'm going somewhere. And I know from one of her friends, who Joan Gunn, and another young lady at the Kiwi Club, Joan told me one night, you'd be quite surprised at the number of dates that Patty scanned when she knew you were coming down. So I was very fond of Patty, very fond indeed.
Obviously had all the right moves.
Yep. Well,
you mentioned obviously her having other suitors, as it were,
mm-hmm.
and passing them up. My impression is that the normal protocols of dating or relationships or are literally thrown out of the window in a situation of war.
Oh, I think that would be a fairly accurate statement, I think. Yeah, because Joan, Patty's friend, said, why not you? You'd be very surprised if you knew the number of dates that Patty has cancelled as soon as she knew you were coming down.
To what degree was that a problem for you, to know that you she had other suitors that might be...
Par for the course.
Were you ever jealous at all?
No.
So... You mentioned that you kept in touch with Irene. What about Patty? I understand you actually caught up later on.
Oh, yes, very much so. When Patty went to London, I saw the group captain asked if he could transfer me. I'd been taken off flying. I'd been made what they call tour, ex-tourist, but... And he said, I can understand you wanting to be close to your little girly chum, Robert. I could fix that for you, no troubles at all. You've been a very good squadron pilot and a good squadron member. I'll be pleased to do that for you. And I said, well, one other thing, sir, if it can be done. Patty is located in London.
You mentioned that you weren't able to get there. What was the situation after that scenario?
Well, I wrote to Patty and said that I couldn't come because all the places that the group captain was going to send me were closing down,
yep.
Because the war was coming to an end. And the grouper said, I spoke out of turn. I was going to send you to transport places as an instructor. But now it's obvious that the war is coming to an end in our favour, and all the places I would have sent you are now either closed or are closing down. And by the time you got there, where you were going to wouldn't exist anymore. We've also started to demob unnecessary persons. So I'm sorry. If I could do it, I wouldn't hesitate. But I can't.
Hmm.
Very sorry that I misled you. So I wrote to Patty and said I couldn't get there, and she wrote back and said, well, it doesn't really matter because we are closing the Kiwi Club down in a matter of days, and we're all bound for New Zealand as soon as the first ship turns up. So if you came here, I wouldn't be here. I'd be somewhere on a ship going to...
After, you obviously were then to come back to Australia. Did you think of flipping off to New Zealand, for instance?
No, because... I went, when the grouper said he couldn't send me to somewhere in London, he had to send me back to Egypt to the RAAF base. And they put me at a, what's called a transit camp, which is a huge place when you're on movement somewhere. And I think it was a place called Cas Ferret, which was right on the Great Bitter Lakes. And we used to spend all day swimming in the lakes, and they had a beautiful restaurant there, very nice. And when the first troop ship came up, I was on the list to go. So I got on board this troop ship life, I tell you, is boring. And the food is unbelievable. So I got on this steamer, went home, and typical RAF, they sailed right past Fremantle, round Melbourne, and I had to come back to Perth by train. So I wrote to Patty, and she said that she was leaving on the something-something Wanganui, which was a New Zealand ship. And when I got home, I told Mum about Pat and showed Mum that photograph, and Mum said, oh, she's a very nice young lady. Yep. So I then got information from the shipping line company that they were leaving, I don't know when they were leaving, but they were going to arrive in Fremantle, whatever day it was, at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and they were sailing at 11:30 that night, just a few hours. I thought, not too wrapped in that. And the problem was in those days that Fremantle was a pretty rough and tough old fishing village, very rough and tough, and there were very few places where you could take somebody that you thought a lot of for a quiet evening meal and be sure that it wouldn't finish up in a fight or knives and all sorts of things. So Mum said to me, what are you going to do about Pat? And I said, an interesting question. I don't want to take it to anyone in Fremantle, but if we come up to the city in a taxi and we have an accident or a blow and Pat misses the ship, she's going to be in awful trouble. And Mum said, we'll bring Patty home for dinner.